The end of one season and the thick of one week for tourism and creativity. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. The 2021 hurricane season is over. It may have been very quiet here, but it was an incredibly busy and powerful season elsewhere. 21 storms flared up, including four major hurricanes. Still, plenty of science to weigh, so what will forecasters be looking at, and what lessons can emergency managers learn? Art Week is here. The carnival of creativity at art fairs across the region returns, even as COVID-19 remains. This year's Art Week is the first since last year's Social Justice Reckoning. So what does inclusion and equity look like in the visual arts? And this year's big buzz, NFT. Can cryptocurrency help paint a different picture for the art industry? It's all ahead on our program made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public broadcasting. Well, the season is over. The 2021 hurricane season came to an official end this week as we rolled over the calendar to December. Did you miss it? It was an awfully quiet one for us, after all, here in South Florida. No hurricanes, no tropical storms. You know, on the map from the National Hurricane Center, plotting all of the paths of the storms this past season, there sticks out the Florida Peninsula, as vulnerable as ever, yet none of the 21 named storms came calling here. Pretty incredible. It was still a pretty incredible, busy, and powerful storm season, just not here in South Florida. It was the third most active on record and the costliest ever. Hurricane Ida alone caused over $60 billion in damages from Louisiana to New England. Several storms quickly strengthened in just a matter of hours, making forecasting difficult, complicating emergency messaging and evacuation plans as well. So while the season may be officially over, there is a lot of work still left to do, a lot of science and even psychology to look at and learn from. So what lessons can we learn about future storms? How does this trend of storms getting stronger much faster impact planning and impact your planning? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to join our conversation. You can also find us on social media. We are at WLRN. Jenny Stiletovich covers the environment for us here at WLRN. Well, we can now finally sleep through the night, right? So here we are in December. We will talk about emergency planning here in a moment. But I'm wondering, with a quiet season here in South Florida, is there a scientific explanation for why we were spared?
Whether or not a storm makes landfall and where, it depends on just the weather conditions at the time. So it's not something they can forecast out in advance. So we could go through storm by storm and figure out why it took one path or another, depending on, you know, pressure systems and the jet stream and all that stuff. But I don't think that there's a forecast into the future, like a reason why.
A lot of science, mix of luck as well, and timing and everything.
Yes, luck is a big part of it.
That's the problem with luck and predictions. It's about the future. So what are the hurricane scientists focus on when they look at the science that was generated by all these 21 storms?
So I think the big gorilla in the room is the rapid intensification that continues to be a concern, because they're not as good at forecasting those yet. Storm track and path they've gotten pretty good at, but the rapid intensification remains an issue. They're also focusing on improving storm surge forecasts. They just rolled those out a few years ago, and after, at the end of every season, they go back and they sort of do a post-game analysis to look for ways to improve.
Yeah, rapid intensification. This is a phrase that we became more familiar with, particularly because of Hurricane Michael when it hit Mexico Beach in the Panhandle a few seasons ago. Describe what that is.
So rapid intensification is when a storm increases wind speed by 35 miles per hour in a day, so in 24 hours, which is a lot.
So it has to do not with the moisture in a storm or the physical size of the storm, but rather the intensity, right? The power within the storm.
Right. They just base it on the measurement of the wind speed. But that wind speed can change the structure of the storm and do, storms that rapidly intensify often have an eyewall replacement. Mm-hmm. And as the eyewall gets replaced, it can spread. It can get bigger in diameter. So that's one of the reasons why they watch it. The bigger a storm is in diameter, the worse the storm surge can be, more widespread, more intense.
Is rapid intensification one of those areas of focus for Hurricane Ida, which was really the big one this year that, you know, followed to some degree a path like Katrina up through New Orleans and then just kind of stayed a pretty serious event all the way up to the East Coast.
Right. So Ida underwent two rapid intensifications. Storms that go through multiple rapid intensifications are especially worrisome. And you're right. Ida came ashore in Louisiana. It lost its, you know, it became sort of a rain event as it hit the Northeast. And then it wasn't the winds driving storm surge. It was just this awful flooding.
So why is this rapid intensification so hard to forecast?
Well, because a lot of it takes place inside the storm. The storm structure influences it. So we know that warmer oceans, weaker wind shear can set the stage for the rapid intensification, but not every storm that meets those conditions undergoes a rapid intensification. So what is it? They think it happens internally, and the internal changes in the storm structure are hard to pick up on a satellite. So the satellite imagery and the sensors that look at ocean temperatures and those other conditions are easy to get, but getting inside a storm and seeing the change in the structure is quite difficult. And so they've had attempts where they've got drones and a different kind of the Global Hawk, a different plane that can fly for longer and trace the storm. But actually looking at the change in the structure, and there's a one of the scientists at the University of Miami, David Nolan, has a lab that specifically looks at rapid intensification, and he's actually gone out when storms hit to try and, you know, set up these sensors that on land that can kind of poke up into the storm.
Oh, my goodness. Trying to unlock that recipe that leads to this rapid intensification is perhaps, you know, the next lockbox, right, for hurricane forecast. As you mentioned, the path, certainly not locked in, but the science around that has really gotten dialed in just over the last few years, certainly compared to what it was just 10 years ago when, you know, this era, 15 years ago during the 2004-2005 hurricane years.
And part of that is because the number of storms that rapidly intensify is increasing. In the 1980s, I think there was a 1 in 100 chance that that a storm would rapidly intensify. Now it's 1 in 20.
Wow.
That's the science from NOAA. That's, I'm going to attribute them.
Understood. And do they have any evidence or any explanation for
why? Well, they certainly think that the warmer ocean temperatures, that climate change that's warming oceans is making it easier for, you know, that stage to be set for rapid intensification. But again, they've got to figure out what's happening internally in the storm. And there's a, you know, it's the, they think there's something called these hot towers where the structure of the storm actually has a, like an internal vortex that allows heat to move up. It's way complicated. I'm not going to pretend that I understand it.
Yeah. But that the idea though, for us, armchair forecasters, 35 mile an hour increase in wind speed over 24 hours, and you've got yourself a rapid intensification storm event.
Right. And in 2020, they had several that underwent, you know, these several or, you know, more than just one rapid intensification. Again, those storms are really.
No. Well, it certainly complicates forecasting. It complicates just planning efforts, right? About, where do you go? Do you stay? When do you make those decisions? And communicating all of that can be difficult. Tracy Jackson certainly knows this, lives it. He's the director of our regional emergency services at Broward County. Tracy, welcome back to WLRN. Nice to have you again.
Hi, good morning. It's super great to be back. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, well, quiet season, so we didn't have much of a chance to talk to you over the last 6 months or reason to talk to you, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but we always enjoy catching up with you. We're focused on this rapid intensification because this is, you know, kind of the leading edge of hurricane science and public safety. So how do you, as an emergency planner, think about rapid intensification? What questions do you have that you need answered when talking about communicating the potential danger as a storm approaches?
Okay, that, Great. I think that primarily for us, our plan involves kind of like worst-case scenario planning. So we always look at it as though the storm is going to hit us. So we treat every storm, if I could say this, as though it might rapidly intensify. And this is a lesson we learned from Dorian. It was sitting on our back porch, so to speak, and it was already pretty strong. And the distance from that storm to our shores is really close. And so that was such a close. What we do now is we run models and we anticipate that the storm is going to go from whatever category it is to the next one up. And then we plan for that category to try to get ahead of it. Communication is key because in a short time frame, there are so many pieces that you have to begin moving that it really requires us to anticipate what might happen and then try to put things in place so that we can move rapidly and hopefully more rapidly than the storm is intense.
What are some of the lessons about storm communications, Tracy, that you witnessed during this 2021 season? Admittedly, again, quiet here for us in South Florida, but you saw the challenge of communication, evacuation, and intensification with Hurricane Ida in the Gulf Coast.
We did indeed. One of the things that I think every community experiences is a certain amount of boredom where people don't really take things seriously until they decide at their level that is going to impact them. Often, by the time they get to that point where they begin to feel uncomfortable, they're already far, far into precious time that's been lost. And so, what we want with that is to be very early when we're communicating, not to fear monger, but to really inform people that in advance of the season, we want to have everybody get ready before we ever get to storm season. And now, since the storm is imminent, the messaging now has to be about getting to the safest place that you can in the time that you have. And so the timing is a really essential part of all of the communications. They discovered it, unfortunately, coast that again, there's a little bit of a lag between those initial announcements and people's response. And so in the hurricane community, we're always to get messages out and into different areas where people hear the message and then respond to it in a timely fashion.
Well, hey, Tracy, let me ask you this. The Hurricane Center says one thing that they worry about is what they call anchoring. It's what a social scientist say, where people will hear the first information they hear about the storm. That tends to be the thing that sticks in their mind. And you just mentioned how, as the storm approaches and the situation changes, you've got to change your messaging. So how do you sort of break through that anchoring problem?
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for that. And Jenny, you're like halfway to a weather scientist. I was listening to you there and all that stuff. So I might get your notes after this call's over. I appreciate it. So human behavior, I think, is going to be the next area for us emergency planners to really begin to leverage. So to your point, Jenny, what we think will be helpful is finding trusted sources of information that are specific to that community. They have communication channels already that are there that they are considering trusting. And if we can get in there, if we can get our message to be relayed by those trusted sources, hopefully when they anchor, it'll be on the legitimate science and fact-based message so that that point that they're anchoring to will be one that they can move from very efficiently and effectively and also very safely. I hope that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
I'm wondering, Tracy, because you've had to plan now for two hurricane seasons during a pandemic, unprecedented time, certainly. Are there storm preparation communication lessons that you've been able to draw out of the public health communication that we've experienced just regionally?
I'm sorry, could you restate that? I had a little
Sure.
audio clip.
Just, as you've had to plan for storm seasons during a pandemic now for 2 years, and likely I would imagine that remains kind of the de facto strategy now, looking at the 2022 hurricane season, expecting COVID-19 to be a reality still. I'm wondering, from a communication standpoint, have you drawn any lessons about how public health experts have been communicating successfully or unsuccessfully regarding the pandemic, and how you could apply that toward storm preparations?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we remain in constant contact with the public health community. As a matter of fact, we have a division called ESF8, which is for public health, which is activated anytime the EOC is activated. And what we found is that there's common obstacles to the messages being clearly communicated and clearly received. One good thing that we've seen them do is that they do have what I'm going to call, I guess, trusted sources. Here in Broward County, the health department has a very good footprint in the community. They do a lot of good work out there on an ongoing basis. And so they're able to communicate down into the areas in the municipalities where people are used to them, where they have a presence, and they're seen as a trusted source of information. And so for us in Broward County, particularly in emergency management, we're looking for community agencies that have that same footprint, if you want to call it that, of a service to the community, and dreaming up ways to get them to be our ambassador. So, for example, let's say there's a park that you and your kids go to all the time, and you know some people there, and you hear from them that, hey, we're having a hurricane meeting, or we're sending an email for some preparation. Would you guys like to be involved? We anticipate that answer is going to be yes, because there's already a relationship there. So the health community seems to be moving in the direction of using their relationships for leverage to communicate their messages, and we think that's a good idea for us as well.
Is a quiet season like we experience here in South Florida make that messaging next April and May that much more difficult for you?
It absolutely does, particularly here in South Florida. As you know, it's difficult to get people motivated. You guys report on it. We've all seen the last minute lines for different types of things. And that was one of our concerns during the first wave of COVID, where early on, we focused on people. The messaging was start early. You're going to have less time and there will be less supplies. So that remains a part of the South Florida culture, unfortunately. And we foresee that a quiet season will mean more complacency. But I do want to say something interesting. So for those of us in emergency planning, the quiet season has like an asterisk next to it, because if anything is happening near us, all emergency managers are watching everything that comes off the coast of Africa. And until it's not a threat to Florida, it's on our radar. So it feels quiet because the storms don't fall. For us, the activity level is exactly the same until we're convinced that the storm doesn't fall. So just to let you know, we're always on the lookout.
Yeah. Jenny, you're nodding your head there. Talk about that because,
No, I was just
we do look
thinking,
at that trough, right? That alley there.
And I was just thinking about the good old days when forecasting wasn't as good and you didn't hear about all these storms out in the middle of the Atlantic. But now that with the launch of the GOES satellite in 2016 and 17, we've just got so many more storms on the map earlier, and smaller. There are a lot of storms that they call them the shorties that would only last for 2 days, and we didn't used to see those, and now we do.
There's been a lot of technology invested, a lot of brain power invested in all of this. And Tracy, for you, it comes down to then motivating somebody to get off their smartphone, off their couch, whatever it is, and get out and make those preparations. So just, how it may be difficult to talk about that now, as we're only just, what, 36 hours into into the lull as we look forward. So, on the communication side, on the preparation side, how is that responding to the science that Jenny spoke about and the questions and some of the answers that some of the hurricane scientists hope to learn from this season?
Okay, so I like that word, the lull. So obviously we're happy about the season ending, and we're looking forward to the lessons that the science community has gained. And there'll be conversations that we have with them, even now in the winter and even in January, as we begin to plan for what our next moves will be. I also want to backtrack for a second about the weather scientists. I just want to put in a plug there. We have the best weather scientists, definitely in the country and maybe in the world, here in our backyard. They're patient, they're thorough, and they spend a lot of time answering questions on the front end of these things. And I remember I don't know if you guys saw, but they put out a August mid-season update. Mm-hmm. And in that update, in August, hey, we expect 15 to 21 named storms this year.
And they nailed it. 21 storms. Got a name.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. Yeah. So the things that they are learning in real time, they find a way to go down and then bring out to the public safety community so that we can hear from them and get a better understanding of how they view the storms, because it helps our planning. So there'll be several meetings that'll be taking place with us in this community in the first part of the year, because this is our, believe it or not, our preparation time. And so understand what they think will happen. They've been modifying their communications to make them clearer and more succinct. And we want to know what those are going to be, because we then turn around and communicate to our stakeholders, to the public, so that everybody, A, knows who the official source of messaging is, and then B, knows what the messaging means, because your average person may not know the difference in a watch or warning. There's some things that get confused out there. And so we're working to simplify the messaging and to really wrap it around the idea of being prepared and not waiting to get prepared is where I see us heading as an industry.
Tracy Jackson is the head of emergency operations in Broward County. Tracy, nice to have you on the program. Thanks for everything.
Thank you all for keeping our community informed and making us all smarter.
We appreciate y'all. Doing our best. Thanks to the community support here at WLRN. Jenny Stiletovich, thank you for sharing all the hurricane science with us as well. Much appreciated.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
All right, we're all going to get some sleep for the next 6 months, hopefully. All right, we're going to shift gears here and talk about Art Week in South Florida. It is that time of year again. So we want to hear, how has last year's social justice reckoning resonated during this year's Art Week in our region? 800-743-WLRN is our phone number. Live phone calls on this Friday afternoon, 800-743-9576. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public broadcasting in your community. It is Art Week in South Florida. Visual arts and art fairs spread across the region again after mostly pausing last year because of the pandemic. What began with Art Basel Miami Beach 2 decades ago has exploded into a region-wide carnival of creativity, celebrating and showcasing contemporary art. So what are your impressions of Art Week? Do you visit an art fair or an art museum this time of year? What do you think of what you see and what the art reflects about our world? 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576 on this Friday afternoon. Maybe you're stuck in some of that Art Week traffic. We'll join our conversation, 800-743-WLRN. One economic analysis estimates that Miami Art Week can account for close to $500 million for the region in economic activity and brings certainly the focus of the art world to our shores and our streets. Carl Joost is a photojournalist for our news partner, the Miami Herald, and founder of the Iris Photo Collective. He says that Miami's art scene is growing, but needs more attention than just for 1 week in December.
I think art ecosystem is the same as the Everglades. It is very unique, it is very fragile, and it needs support.
What do you think of that comparison? The art ecosystem in South Florida, the same as the Everglades. While this year's Art Week comes as the COVID-19 pandemic continues, it also is the first since the social justice reckoning protests and movement in the summer of 2020. So what does equity and inclusion look like during Art Week and beyond? And how does whose art is shown help shape the view of art and what it expresses? Join us, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mikhail Solomon is with us, the director of the Prism Art Fair, and Deisha Carrington is with the Arts Membership Program Commissioner. To each of you, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time on this, I'm sure, a very busy Art Week for you.
Thank you for having us.
Of course. Mikhail, let me start with you. Your art fair has published online on your website a statement of diversity and inclusion. Why did you decide to make that statement?
Because we just realized how important it is to acknowledge our collective humanity and to ensure that artists, no matter what ethnic background you come from, that they have representation in what has become a huge economic economic driver in Miami's community, but also globally. And that we also want to make sure that our organization is adhering to standards that ensures that our employment and our engagement with folks that we work with is also transparent in its efforts to ensure that we have a diverse staff, that we are showing a diverse group of artists. I think that that should be a policy for every organization that exists. So that was our need, especially with everything that was happening last year, especially with humanity's history, with just coming to grips with dealing with diversity, that it was important for us to make that statement.
Mikhail, how would you describe the transparency or lack thereof regarding representation during Miami Art Week, which can be hard to exactly, you know, define, right? Like there's not just one, you know, it's Art Basel is one single art show, art fair, but there are dozens and dozens and dozens that that participate in what has become Art Week.
Yeah, I mean, Prism was born out of what we felt was a gap in the market. We, at the time when I started Prism, I'd been to Basel, I'd been to a number of fairs, and there was very little representation of diverse voices in those fairs. And so our answer to that was to create a fair that that was a representation of the segment of the market that wasn't being shown as broadly as it could have been in other platforms. You're seeing an emergence of the galleries and artists being represented at Basel and other fairs like Untitled, et cetera, now. Mm-hmm. But prior, there was a paucity of offerings. Mm-hmm. And so as a fair that focuses on African and diaspora artists, our hope is that we will always be a space where you can find artists. We have, to date, we have essentially shown up to 565 artists from the global African diaspora, and I hope that number continues to grow. And we also show artists who are emerging as well as established.
Yeah. DJ, let me ask you your impressions of equity inclusion efforts during Art Week.
Well, you know, it's always wonderful to connect with the global diaspora, which really descends upon Miami during Miami Art Week, you know, to be able to connect with artists and curators and folks like Mikhail in these spaces where we can think about the ideas, be surrounded and immersed in the art and have robust conversations. You know, one artist that I'm thinking of in particular is Shire Reagans, who is local, as well as Lonnie Johnson. And they deal a lot with memory work. You know, tomorrow they'll be leading a procession around, you know, to commemorate, to honor victims of gun violence. Mm-hmm. And their families, and it's a community gathering. So I think while Art Week really offers us an opportunity to gather, the issues around equity and diversity are year-round, they're systemic, they're deep-rooted, and there's a lot of people on the ground who are already mobilizing and thinking of different ways to expand the conversation. So I think Art Week can be a place, you know, for people to come together. But I think there's also more intentionality. I hope there's more intentionality. And I know that's certainly true for a group of artists and curators who are thinking that way.
Yeah, I'm curious, what do you think has driven that intentionality? How much of that has had its short-term roots in what we experienced, for instance, last summer? Or, well, I guess it was the summer of 2020 now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it depends on which audience, right, we're speaking of, because there have been a lot of people who have been doing a lot of work for a very long time toward advancing equity and diversity in our society, right? So, and certainly those folks are here during Miami Art Week, they're here year round. But in terms of the art marketplace, I think that's very different than the creative process and the artistic process. process. And I think in some ways, having language and education and really using last year in some ways, the calling in or the calling out as an opportunity to grow, reflect, maybe even stop and shift has happened. But for others, you know, I wonder if that's really taken place.
Tell me a little bit more about that skepticism.
I think it's less around skepticism and just more around the idea that we need to continue organizing. So, you know, Art Basel and, you know, the fair marketplace, it very much is around the dynamics and the economy, right, of the art marketplace. And that moves at a different pace as social justice does. And so I think, right, we have many more opportunities to bridge that gap. And people like Mikhail and Prism Art Fair, who are even within their own systems thinking about using technology or blockchain or NFTs as a way to give more agency to artists, is one of the ways that the gaps are being bridged.
Yeah, we're going to talk more, in fact, about NFTs in just a few moments here on this program. Mikhail, what about this intentionality? And I'm wondering how it is being expressed or how the expression of that intentionality has been reflecting social issues over the last 18 or 20 months that have been so prominent now.
Well, I mean, I think Deja made some great points with regards to how we think about systemically changing the way the artists that are participating in the market are engaged. And for us, we are extremely intentional about ensuring that the long-term economic viability of the artists that participate in our fair is preserved and protected. And we mentioned NFTs and blockchain, and we understand how revolutionary this technology can be for artists if it's leveraged in the right way. And what we're exploring this year with the participation of our artists is that each artist actually has an NFT minted to go along with the physical art piece that they're exhibiting in the show. And it functions as a digital certificate of authenticity, so that the work can also always be tracked on the blockchain. And once the artist, if for instance, an artist does or a patron that purchased the artwork from Prism decides that they want to resell it after a grace period, and there is a grace period as well, the collector has to hold on to the work for a certain amount of time, then the artist will then receive an agreed upon percentage of the resale, and that will happen in perpetuity. So that is like a really important thing, because I believe that the visual arts market is the only market where the artists don't receive some form of royalty for the resale of their, what I consider their intellectual property.
Right. Once the artist sells the work, generates maybe that initial income, then whatever resale happens from there, it's that new owner and then the new owner and the new owner. And if you're curious, folks listening, if you're saying what's an NFT and how does this relate to art, well, hold on. We're going to talk about and define that concept, because it is one of the biggest things happening in the art world, as the art world has brought its focus back to South Florida here during this Art Week. We're talking about it with Mikhail Solomon with Prism Art Fair and DJ Carrington with Arts Membership Program Commissioner. I want to read to you a headline of a Washington Post article that was published in the last 24 hours. The headline reads, "At Miami's Art Basel, a canvas of global inequality in the pandemic age." And the column begins with this sentence: "On the Rolls-Royce clogged avenues of this Art Deco dreamland, the global 1% are back and richer than ever." So, DJ, I'll start with you. How does Art Basel, and some argue maybe Art Week, represent square with equity, inclusion, social justice efforts when it comes to the art world?
Well, I think that, again, it's not a real juxtaposition. I think social justice, equity, this is life that we're talking about. It's bigger than the art world. It's bigger than our jobs. It's bigger than anything, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, to think that an art fair will directly address those issues that are much more deep-rooted, right? I think that's naive. And I do think that it kind of reminds me of a headline even a few years ago, right, that said Black art is finally having its moment. Now, today, you would see social justice is finally having its moment. That's just not true. So I would disagree. I would disagree with the premise of the article.
Yeah. Mikhail, what are your thoughts? And granted, I'm just reading you just a short slice, so it's like trying to judge a piece of art through a pinhole. A bit unfair, right, necessarily, but just this juxtaposition on Art Basel's, you know, the brand, you know, the global brand, the global 1%, as this columnist writes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I try not, I mean, I personally try not to place so much emphasis on, I guess the descendants of this global 1% that does come to Miami during Art Basel. I mean, I think there is a robust hyper-local conversation around Miami Art Week that I personally prefer to place my attention and focus on. Mm-hmm. And it's projects like Commissioner, for instance. Mm-hmm. Commissioner is doing such a wonderful job at making sure that the local community in Miami understands what this all means, and giving them, giving our local community tools for efficacy around how to collect work and how to be participants in what is our local arts and culture scene. So I understand that, you know, Art Basel is this sort of behemoth that comes to Miami,
right,
and sort of takes over. But I think it's more important for us to, and that's not in any way to like discredit, you know, what has become an economic boom for our community. But I think it's also important to understand that our local artists, our local creative economy that exists even beyond Art Basel, and projects like Commissioner are just such an incredible part of what makes Miami a good place, a fantastic place to even attract projects like Art Basel, yeah, and Untitled and all these other fairs.
DJ, probably for as long as there's been the Art Basel Miami Beach, there have been observations and even criticisms about the Art Basel show and representation of South Florida artists generally. Mm-hmm. So that kind of criticism certainly not new, but I'm curious, kind of as the Basel brand is back and Art Week has expanded, do you have a sense that, you know, Art Week perhaps has been able to kind of stand out on its own, maybe a little bit more than perhaps it had been able to in earlier years?
Well, I think there's a lot of exciting things that are happening here for Miami-based artists. I mean, when you think of it, we have two artists, Jared McGriff and Reginald O'Neill, right now, who both have solo museum shows, one at NSU in, mm-hmm, Fort Lauderdale and the other at the Rubel Museum. You know, last night I saw a film, Lost Underground, for which Commissioner was a supporter, along with Oolite, Locust Projects, mm-hmm, and Untitled. And it was about queer nightlife and how, you know, those spaces were about self-preservation, care, friendship, and community, especially during times of pandemic when that kind of community care was most necessary. I mean, so many of the artists that Mikhail are showing, Jermaine Barnes, who's one of the featured artists at Design Miami, along with the Lexus Project, and he is based right here. And in his show that he recently had at the MoMA, really did a case study on Miami, on Blackness, on the African diaspora and our Caribbean communities here. So I think that local artists aren't necessarily only being viewed these days as Miami artists, but rather as Miami-based artists who are making a global impact and putting their ideas forward.
We're going to talk more about Art Week here in a moment with DJ Carrington, with Commissioner, that's an arts membership program, and Mikhail Solomon is the head of the PRISM Art Fair. We're going to talk about one of the biggest buzziest things leading up to Art Basel itself, not the art, but blockchain technology, NFTs. 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We are back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting public broadcasting. Well, the last time Art Basel came to Miami Beach, a banana and a piece of duct tape were all the rage. This year, the big buzz in the lead up to Art Week has been blockchain. It's the same technology behind cryptocurrencies. NFT, it's the acronym that you heard us talking about just a few moments ago. It's shorthand. It stands for non-fungible token. That doesn't really explain what it is either, does it? Well, it's a way to make to essentially take a piece of art, or really just about any digital file, and give it a unique kind of digital stamp and allow people to then buy and sell it. It allows a digital work to be, quote unquote, owned. It allows artists and others to put a price on it. It allows artists to be able to collect perhaps a royalty from the resale of their art after they have sold it initially. There are holographic NFTs at Art Basel. There's even one that's included in the DNA of a bacterial organism. Miami's been working to make itself one of the most connected cities of the world to cryptocurrencies. So maybe it was just only natural that the worlds of cyber money and art would collide here on our shores. 800-743-WLRN. Are you a cryptocurrency investor, trader? What about an art aficionado and this collision between art and blockchain technology? 800-743-9576. Jorge Cortez is joining us now with Bit Basel. Jorge, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, everybody. And I appreciate your invitation and thank you for all your audience.
Well, thank you. Have you sold any NFTs this week?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. We have been having a tremendous week here of social impact and bridging the gap between what's going on around the world and what's going on with the local communities. We have a full agenda of artists, of the cryptocurrency industry, really contributing to what's possible for the local artists here in Miami. And I couldn't be more grateful. We have Dr. Sion Proctor from Inspiration 4 of SpaceX. She's an artist and an astronaut as well. Mm-hmm. And has been doing tremendous work for St. Jude with some of their pieces. And she also sold her piece last night for 22 ETH. So we're glad to be supportive and to host real impact through the use of technology and NFTs. We have artists, we have Isaiah Jackson from Bitcoin and Black America as well, guiding the way and really having the most amazing times with the artists here for a full week of the industry leaders in the Bitcoin and cryptocurrency industries gathered here at the Sagamore Hotel.
Jorge, let me ask you, we were talking earlier about NFTs for artists with DJ Carrington, with the Arts Membership Program Commissioner, and Mikhail Solomon with Prism Art Fair, and they're still with us. But as an entrepreneur here at this intersection between art and technology with Bit Basel, what, Jorge, do you think the promise of NFTs is for the artistic community?
Absolutely. Well, I would love to talk about what describe or answer that with the work that Bit Basel has been doing all this year, taking traditional artists into a journey, a learning curve journey of learning about blockchain and NFT so that they can launch their collections. And we have tons of dozens of these local artists here in Miami that were previously selling their art pieces for perhaps $200, $300. And now with the proper mindset and understanding of their technology as a new, perhaps, technique, they are being able to sell their pieces as NFTs for 2 or 3 or 5 ETH Ethereum, which translate to perhaps $7,000 or $8,000 or $10,000.
You mentioned the Ethereum is a cryptocurrency that that trades then and can be converted into dollars. So what how do you explain that value difference of a piece of art, a physical piece of art that may have gone for $200 as an NFT, a non-fungible token, is going for a multiple of that.
Well, the NFT is a digital representation of the perhaps the physical piece, but as an NFT or as an encryption, as a smart contract in nature, it could represent anything that the artist wanted want to represent, which means that the NFT can also include the physical pieces if the artist want to. So we were taking the approach of taking it as a new technique that's digital and that they are able to submit and create and be more creative from with their art on the digital arts arena, perhaps, and having a tremendous immediate impact on their revenue, their income as small or independent or small businesses or independent artists.
So Jorge, this example here, apologies for the interruption. You have some cases where a non-fungible token digital representation of a piece of art is being sold along with the physical object, the painting or the sculpture?
Correct. Inside the NFT, let's remember it is a smart contract in nature. It could include any type of file or representation, like a video or an animation or an MP3 or an MP4 or literally a documentary. It could be a movie. It could be your book. And so as a digital piece, it can include the physical piece as well inside the smart contract. Yeah. It is chose by the author however they want to paint it.
It's up to the artist. Mikhail Solomon with Prism Art Fair, you have embraced NFTs. What about the acceptance of artists?
So our artists have actually, and please forgive me if there's noise in the background.
it's a working art fair after all.
So our artists have actually fully embraced this idea. They have themselves have become very nervous about, especially with articles that came out in ArtNet, for instance, about a fairly well-known artist named Amy Sherald, whose work had been resold recently in the secondary market, and she unfortunately doesn't receive any royalty from that resale.
Right.
These are major concerns that all of any artist that I've spoken to has had for quite some time. And so when I presented this approach as an opportunity for them to preserve those rights for themselves long term, they were really open to experimenting with it and learning more about it going forward. And it's actually been I'm very happy to see that even our collector base is open to it. And it also helps us kind of weed out which collectors are sincere about preserving the long-term economic rights of the artist versus the ones who are sort of just in it to kind of buy and invest and perhaps flip the work.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that we're working with collectors who are actually interested in looking out for the long-term best interests of the artists that we work with.
DJ, let me for the interruption. We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to get DJ Carrington with Commissioner back into the conversation. DJ, does this reduce the importance of the art gallery system and art fairs even, like we're experiencing with Art Week?
I think it's all about the ecosystems. There's so many different parts of what makes a creative life or life in the arts possible, from the institutions to the art fairs to the curators, and of course, most importantly, the artists themselves. And I think there's a role for all of us to play. I think what's really interesting with NFTs is that it's expanded the conversation. People who have never been, to my mind, really interested in the art are all of a sudden starting to ask different kinds of questions or thinking about this differently. So I think there's more room for everyone to get involved in the conversation, no matter which approach they prefer to take.
DJ Carrington is with Arts Membership Program Commissioner, Mikhail Solomon with Prism Art Fair, and Jorge Cortez with Bit Basel. To the three of you, thanks for spending a little bit of this Art Week Friday with us here on WLRN. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you, and all of your audience as well. Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And that will do it for our program here today on the South Florida Roundup. It is produced by Amber Amortigi. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and above all, supporting public broadcasting here in South Florida. Thanks for all you do. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support for making WLRN possible. Be sure to have a safe, happy, and healthy weekend. Don't forget you can catch a podcast of this program by searching South Florida Roundup on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on social media as well. Look for WLRN. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Catch us there. Let us know what's happening during your Art Week weekend. I'm Tom Hudson. Again, have a great weekend. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.
WLRN Public Media.